Hello, podcast listeners. Today's a very special episode with Dr. Robert Eccles. Robert is the founding chairman of the Sustainability Accounting Standards Board and visiting professor of management practice at the Side Business School. Robert earned his PhD in sociology from Harvard University. In today's episode, he discusses the state of ESG reporting and ESG investment strategies. I'd like to welcome Robert and all our listeners to the podcast.
This podcast is sponsored by the Hidden Value Stocks newsletter. Published once a quarter, the Hidden Value Stocks newsletter contains at least two interviews with up-and-coming hedge fund managers and their top two favorite investment ideas. Each newsletter subscriber not only receives a detailed investment thesis on each idea, but we will also provide direct access to the fund's profile, as well as their quarterly updates. We are proud to report that the average annualized return of all 60 stocks profiled in Hidden Value Stocks since inception is 27.9%, with an average holding period of 319 days. To download a 10-page teaser issue or sign up for a 5-day free trial, head over to hiddenvaluestocks.com. Podcast listeners can get 35% off the annual subscription price with discount code VIP19.
Welcome to Value Talk with Raul.
Just wanted to welcome all our listeners to a very special episode with Robert Eccles, founding chairman of the Sustainability Accounting Standards Board. Robert, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Natalie. Nice to be here.
All right. So now we can start with the questions. So to kick things off, can you tell our listeners a bit about your background and how it led you to SASB and your other work?
Oh, gosh. I mean, it's a long and shaggy dog story, so I'll try and make it brief. Before I got my PhD at Harvard, I got two degrees at MIT in math and history, so it was an odd combination. But I was always interested in measurement, and my dissertation was about measurement and gauging the Industrial Revolution. And then I went to Harvard Business School, and my first book was on transfer pricing, so it's how you'd measure profits inside a company. Then I wrote a book on investment banks, and that was my introduction to the capital markets when I was an associate professor. When I got tenure, I was developing a new course called Information Organization and Control and was talking to people to develop some cases, and I published an article 30 years ago now in the Harvard Business Review called the Performance Measurement Manifesto. And the basic thesis was that companies were starting to measure so-called non-financial information around environmental and social issues, intellectual capital, human capital. Had a couple of sentences in there that maybe the SEC one day would start requiring that this be reported. That clearly hasn't happened for a long time, but we're sort of getting there. About 4 years later, I published a paper called Improving the Corporate Disclosure Process that I did with Sarah Mavrinac, where we did surveys of sell-side analysts and buy-side portfolio managers and companies asking about reporting. And there was a general agreement that more non-financial information would be important, but the investment community wasn't getting it, and companies agreed they weren't reporting it. And part of it was they just didn't have good standards for doing so. That then led to me working with PricewaterhouseCoopers on a couple of books. One was called The Value Reporting Revolution, Moving Beyond the Earnings Game. The other was Building Public Trust, The Future of Corporate Reporting. And I just continued to dig deeper and deeper and deeper into this question around reporting and how to supplement financial reporting with other reporting. Then I wrote two books on integrated reporting in 2010, a book called One Report with Mike Cruz, and then another one, The Integrated Reporting Movement. We published that 5 years later. And by then, things had started to evolve quite a bit. The GRI was founded in 1997. They did good work, and maybe we can get into this in more detail later. Their focus was really stakeholders, and the way they defined materiality was essentially externalities, what activities companies were engaged in that were making the world a better or a worse place. And then, as you indicated, I was the founding chairman of the Sustainability Accounting Standards Board, you know, the woman who had the idea, a good friend of mine, Jean Rogers. And her thesis was a very, I think, compelling one, which was, Regulation SK in the United States basically says, you know, material information needs to be reported, and it doesn't say it has to be financial. It doesn't even say it has to be quantitative. And so she was saying, look, what's material really is a function of a company's industry. And in building public trust, which I wrote with Sam DiPiazza, who was the global chair of PwC at the time, we had a kind of three-tier model that there would be what we call global gap, where we were looking for a convergence between IFRS and US gap, and then industry-specific standards, which basically what Gene was looking at, and then company-specific information. So Gene's idea resonated with me, and I became the founding chairman of SASB, and then much has happened since then. I published a little piece earlier this year, I think, called 2020, the Year the Narrative Changed for Sustainability Reporting, and we can get into this more. But I think, you know, the arc of the story is that this has gone from lunatic fringe activity, the earlier things I was publishing nobody cared about. It's kind of nuts. And the value reporting revolution was published just as the, you know, internet was kind of reaching its peak, and then the bubble burst and people worried about other things. Then you had, as I said, the Global Reporting Initiative was founded, and, you know, CDSB and CDP is a data platform. The IRC, I was one of the founders of that. That was 2010. I guess SASB was 2011. And now we see where it's gone from kind of lunatic fringe to, you know, a small community is paying attention to it, to going very, very mainstream. And it's now really become part of what the regulators are looking at. The SEC is looking for climate disclosures to make rulemaking on that. The IFRS Foundation has established an International Sustainability Standards Board. And you've got the EU taxonomy and the Corporate Sustainability Reporting Directive. So we've kind of moved from simply NGOs trying to create these standards to governments, you know, looking into this in a very serious way. And they obviously have more power to establish what the standards and reporting requirements are going to be on companies. So probably too long of an introduction, Natalie, but I think that kind of lays the groundwork for whatever you want to discuss.
I 100% agree. And it sounds like you've basically been on the forefront of non-financial reporting since, like you said, it was an idea associated with ecological activists to now being something that the SEC wants and Larry Fink of BlackRock is saying needs to happen as well. So with that, I'd like to ask for your thoughts on the current state of sustainability reporting and integrated reporting. Like you said, one of the biggest issues with ESG is that it's not standardized to the extent financial reporting is. So the IFRS Foundation is currently trying to set up a parallel organization called the International Sustainability Standards Board, ISSB. How optimistic are you that this is going to be a game changer?
So I tend to be a glasses half full kind of guy. I mean, there's, you know, there's always issues with these things. I'm really quite optimistic. I mean, it's been a huge step for the IFRS Foundation, which has been solely focused on financial reporting, which is obviously very important, to publish a consultation, which they did in September, proposing an International Sustainability Standards Board. And one of the reasons I'm encouraged, if you look at the responses that they got, and I think it was around 575 or 580, you know, there was really very, very overwhelming support, particularly from the investment community. And let's remember that, you know, all of these reporting standards, whether it's for financial or non-financial or sustainability reporting, whatever language you want to use, and there's, you know, kind of food fights around the language, it's for the benefit of investors. I mean, the SEC was formed for the benefit of investors. We didn't always have accounting standards and reporting requirements. That came with the SEC. So we're going to measure things in the same way. We're going to do revenue recognition the same way. Apples to apples, companies have to report. This accounting standards and reporting requirements is infrastructure for the capital markets we all take for granted. And it's led to a lot of value creation. I think it's been unevenly distributed. We don't have that same plumbing, if you will, for sustainability reporting or for non-financial reporting. Groups like SASB and GRI, I think, have done good work. It's very different when you have a multilateral body like the IFRS Foundation. Virtually every country in the world uses IFRS, International Financial Reporting Standards, except the typical US exceptionalism with US GAAP. For them to say they're going to put a stake in the ground and create standards for sustainability reporting is a huge deal. Now, they can't mandate that. They can set the standards, but then governments have to decide if those standards are going to apply to their jurisdictions. And then that's where it gets tricky, right? Because you've got the US, as I said, has got its own set of accounting standards, and they're not all that different. We won't get into the details. But the SEC is doing rulemaking on climate, and it seems to be relatively narrowly focused on that. And we've got the usual issue here with political polarization and, you know, the politicization of COVID-19 and climate change, but I won't get into that. Then you've got the EU really pushing for something much more aggressive. You've got the EU taxonomy, and then sort of as part of that, the Corporate Sustainability Reporting Directive. And this is a little bit down in the weeds, but it's important. There's this big debate, and this was the big debate in the letters that were submitted to the IFRS Foundation on their consultation for the ISB on so-called single materiality versus double materiality. What do I mean by that? Single materiality is essentially, and I think it's awkward language, but it came out of the EU, and so we're stuck with it. But single materiality is really what information is important to investors for value creation, enterprise value creation. That's the focus of accounting standards. That's the focus of SASB. Double materiality refers to information that is important to other stakeholders, is important to the world. Investors may not care about it yet. Investors always didn't care about climate change, but they might over time as things change. You know, this notion of dynamic materiality I've been developing with some people. The CSRD is coming down pretty strongly through something called EFRAG, the European Financial Reporting Advisory Group, working with GRI, you know, double materiality. And as a government, you can say, you know, you have to report on this. And, you know, it may not be important to investors, but we're the state and we can decide. So what I see happening, what I would ideally like to see is that the International Sustainability Standards Board establish what people are calling a global baseline. And they're going to start with climate and other environmental issues, and then I think fairly quickly move into social issues like diversity, equity, and inclusion. And I think income inequality is an important topic. It contributes to system level risk. Maybe we can get into that later. They will be the global baseline. The SEC will be more narrowly focused, although they have come out with some principles on human capital reporting in the previous administration. One of the few good things that happened in the previous administration, I should say. The EU will come up with a longer list, and it's going to go into legislation in April. So let's say, just to pick some numbers, that the EU has in their Corporate Sustainability Reporting Directive, which will apply to 50,000 companies, both public and private. So it's not just public companies. That's interesting. And may apply to US companies that have got subsidiaries in Europe. Also interesting. Let's say there's 20. And let's say the global baseline has 8. And let's say the SEC comes up with 2, because that's all they can get through, because we have Republicans. As long as whatever those issues are that are common to all three of these standard-setting organizations are measured the same way, then that's really important progress, because investors don't care where a company is located. So we agree that we're going to measure carbon emissions this way. There's no perfect way. I like to say that these standards, whether it's accounting or non-financial, there's social constructs. There's always debate about what's the best way to do it. You know, what's the best way to do depreciation, revenue recognition, whatever it is. Let's just get a social consensus. That becomes the reality that we use. People incorporate into decision-making. They get data over time, do longitudinal analysis. So if we can get to that point, the ISB launches at COP26. The SEC does the rulemaking by the end of the year. The EU taxonomy launches in the CSRD legislation in April, then I think we've got a really solid foundation, as long as these people play well with each other, to move the ball forward in terms of corporate reporting in a very substantial way.
That was all very interesting. And I am curious, you talked a lot about Europe and the US when it comes to implementing these new standards in some way, shape, or form. Are you optimistic that the same will happen in emerging markets like China, or do you think they'll be slower on actually adopting these standards?
You know, so let's talk about China. China's an interesting situation. I'm reasonably familiar with China, as much as an old white guy that doesn't speak Chinese can be. China's very interesting. The Ministry of Finance, and in China, the Ministry of Finance is in charge of the group that sets the accounting standards. They wrote a very positive letter to the International Sustainability Standards Board in support of what they're doing. And now, as we're getting to have this become a reality, there's this question of where is it going to be located? And a Chinese friend of mine who lives in Beijing, on WeChat, which is what everybody uses in China, so I've got a Chinese WeChat account. She sent me this very interesting article about how China has basically, you know, sort of put in, I guess technically a bid, but the offer to have the International Sustainability Standards Board be based in Beijing. And I know that I think Germany has made a pitch for it, and I think Canada's made a pitch for it. So, I mean, I don't know where it's going to end up, and maybe it'll be in multiple locations. But if China wasn't enthusiastic about what the ISB was doing, for sure, they wouldn't have been kind of raising their hand to say, you know, we're willing to put up some money to have it based here. So I actually think China, I think Japan, well, they're not an emerging market, and I don't really think of China as an emerging market either, to tell you the truth. But I think, you know, kind of pretty much, I think you'll get global support. In the emerging markets, I think the question is kind of like there's the emerging markets and then there's the small and medium-sized enterprises in any market, whether it's developed or developing. There's a question of, is this reporting going to be too burdensome? You know, it's one thing for big companies to have to do this, but again, I don't think it's that much. We're talking a relatively small number, you know, of things that need to be reported on. And as a side, I can tell you, I'm doing a big research project on private equity. I've probably talked to about 80 people that are GPs and LPs at this point. And I won't get into how interesting the private equity industry is in terms of its evolution, but I'm struck by some of the most sophisticated GPs, the level of detail, non-financial information that they're getting from their portfolio companies, which are by definition SMEs, is quite a lot. So I think you're going to have, you know, this be adopted pretty much around the world, developed and developing, emerging markets, IFRS. And then there's a G7 task force, you know, on reporting that is being led by Doug Peterson at S&P and Ronnie Cohen, who's done, just pioneering work in impact measurement, has the Impact Weighted Accounts Initiative at Harvard with my buddy, George Serafim. So this is going to be a report submitted to the G7 around reporting. So there's a lot of things going on. As I said, I think it's a very exciting time. And so, you know, things will fall into place or they weren't, or they won't over the next, you know, couple of years. Look, it'll be messy. It'll be contentious. Standard setting always is. It's still that way for financial reporting. But we've gone a long way from my first little paper in HBR in 1991, which is like nobody really cares about the external reporting stuff. Bob Kaplan did a very nice paper the year later on the balanced scorecard. That got a lot of traction, but it wasn't connected to external reporting. Now we're connecting this to external reporting. Investors want it, other stakeholders want it, and companies are increasingly recognizing the benefit to themselves of having a set of standards so that their performance on the kind of sustainability issues that are material to them, they can get recognized for in the capital markets, which they kind of complain about hasn't been the case today, although companies whine about a lot of stuff. And one of the reasons they don't get credit for is they don't do a very good job of reporting on it, and they do it in a silo and they don't incorporate it in the earnings calls and the investor meetings and the capital market days and so forth. But I think all of that is changing.
Right, for sure. And one of the interesting things that comes to my mind when we're thinking about especially emerging markets and these new sustainability standards reporting is how they kind of go hand in hand with their economic and sustainable development goals as a country overall. Especially when we're thinking of countries like China, where 2/3 of the market capital is tied up in state-owned enterprises. It seems that they already have a stake involved in having to think about these non-strictly financial goals as well.
Well, you know, I can tell you in China, I'm doing an interesting project. Probably not supposed to tell you about this, but that's okay. I'll tell you anyway. I'm doing a very interesting project with the City of London and my colleague Judith Strola, who's at Said with me, and Christine Chow, who was at Federated Hermes EOS, and she's now at IJS Market, and my good friend Deutschan Wong, who's got his own firm, Governance Solutions Group, in China. So we're looking at the so-called value creation of engagement and stewardship in China. And as part of that, we've done interviews with a number of Chinese asset owners and asset managers. And, you know, while the primary focus has been around engagement and stewardship, not surprisingly, this question of metrics and reporting comes up because you need the information to know what you're going to do in your engagement with companies.
And there's always issues with transparency when it comes to countries like China. And
there's always issues of transparency, you know, and even with the accounting, you know, or the audits being properly done. But, you know, China's a funny place, right? My experience in China is that you go and you see people and you meet with people and you get a memorandum of understanding. And there's like this pretty thing that you put on the wall and nothing happens. And then you wake up the next morning and boom, it's happened. So it's a very non-linear place, and it's clearly a top-down place, and you've got President Xi Jinping that can, you know, decide a lot. I mean, it's more complicated than people think because the provincial governors may or may not follow along. But, you know, when the Chinese state decides they want to get behind something, and you're right to point out the importance of the SOEs, you know, things can move very quickly.
Right, for sure. So I'd like to take this conversation back from abroad, as interesting as all that was, to the US. So in the US, we have a big emphasis on shareholder primacy, where the the needs of the shareholders, which we typically interpret to mean value maximization, are supposed to come above everything else, including sustainability and ESG. So you've previously written that, quote, shareholder primacy is an ideology, not the law. Can you expand upon this?
Sure. And so we'll focus on the US for now. You know, what the law says, and it's the law varies by state, but, you know, most of the very large companies are Delaware corporations. And it's a question of fiduciary duty. You know, the duty of the board is to whom? In most countries, it's very clearly the duty is to the corporation, not to shareholders. It's a little bit more nuanced in the United States. It's to the corporation, you know, and its shareholders. Judge Leo Strein, who's a good friend of mine, who was the former Chief Justice of the Delaware Supreme Court. So, you know, the man knows what he's talking about. He and I have written a piece with Colin Mayer where, and then we've written with Tim Yeomans also at Federated Hermes. Under Delaware law, directors may take account of other stakeholders. They need to do so from the perspective of value maximization for shareholders. But that's not really a big conflict because, you know, what we've shown, research I've done, people have done a lot more, particularly George Seraphim, is that, you know, managing these material sustainability issues contributes to financial performance. So even under kind of a shareholder primacy, if you sort of extend the time frame, where there's an ideology is that, you know, okay, our duty is only to shareholders and it's to maximize shareholder return. And these other things don't matter as long as we're not violating any kind of laws. So that's where the ideology comes in. You see similar ideology coming in when under the Trump administration, I can't list the number of terrible things that happened under the Trump administration. One of them was this nutcase ruling out of the Department of Labor around ERISA, where they got 5,000 letters and 95% disagreed with it and they did it anyway, but now that's going back the other way, where you've got this ideology on the investor side, that the fiduciary duty on the investor side is to maximize returns for beneficiaries, and that somehow sustainability, the way Commissioner Hester Pierce writes about it, that's another long story and I've written on that, is somehow like a transfer payment or it's philanthropy. No, they are reading ideology into basically, you know, how you create economic value. So then the Business Roundtable, they come out because they, okay, we see how the world is changing and other stakeholders matter and it's important to value creation. A couple of years ago, they come out with their famous statement of the purpose of a corporation. I got to tell you, this drives me a little nuts. So they say this is like, you know, the most important thing we published on corporate governance since our white paper in 1997. And when you read the 1997 white paper, it is very direct shareholder primacy. Now they say, look, these other stakeholders matter. And people go, well, that's great. You know, that's kind of where the world is going, particularly Europe. Okay, if it's that big a deal, did you check with your board of directors? So Lucian Bebchuk, my buddy at Harvard Law School, and his colleague Robert Tallarita, also at Harvard Law School, they published a nice paper. And they found that, you know, almost none of these CEOs, and it's usually the combined chairman, CEO, imperial CEO in the United States, checked with their board. I'm thinking, I don't get it. If this is such a big deal, if this is such a breakthrough, and you signed the statement of the purpose of the corporation, maybe you want to run it by your board of directors just to say, boys and girls, okay with this. You go and you talk to these companies and they go, I mean, we've been doing purpose for years. No problem. You know, we didn't need to run this by our board. We've been doing purpose for years. And I'm thinking that dog doesn't hunt. You can't have it both ways. This can't be the greatest thing since sliced bread in 1997. Enormous breakthrough, and we should all be patting ourselves on the back about it, but then say, oh, because we've been doing it forever, we don't really need to run it by the board of directors. So, you know, there's a lot of kind of purpose washing. I've done a lot of research on this with my colleagues at Oxford. You know, my colleague Shivaram Rajagopal at Columbia Business School done a very nice paper, looked at the BRT signatories and compared them to others. They actually perform worse on a lot of things. There have been other issues. So the narrative is changing, just like it's kind of changing around non-financial reporting, recognizing that, you know, the purpose of a company is important. It's not just to create short-term shareholder value. I think the actions aren't catching up, but I think the deeper question about purpose has to do with company law and the corporate form. So as I said, you know, what Judge Strein says is that under Delaware law, shareholders may take account, and they've got broad latitude, more latitude than they actually use. They've got duty of loyalty, duty of care. As long as they're kind of adhering to those things, it's fine. There's a thing called the public benefit corporation, where there is a positive duty that the directors have to an environmental or social goal that is the benefit the company says it wants to create. And there's a California company called Viva Systems, about $40 billion in market cap last I looked, converted to the PBC status, I think earlier this year, with 99% of the shareholder vote. So for me, the fundamental question, and it's kind of the issue that underlies single versus double materiality, is what is the purpose of the corporation? Why do we have companies? We've had a corporate form based on company law, which is, you know, maybe 100 years old, the modern corporation, 120. World has changed a lot, tremendous concentration, you know, in a fairly small number of large companies. Externalities are huge. Climate change is real. Income inequality is real. They're both destabilizing. So I think we need a fundamental rethink in terms of company law. And you see that in some jurisdictions. Ironically enough, you see some more here than other places where there is a different basis of what the fiduciary duty is of the board, where they actually have a positive duty to an environmental or social benefit. It doesn't constrain how much money they can make. They don't have to say that creating this benefit is going to make them lose money. In fact, if you do it right, you can have it both ways. With focus, it's the material issues. Unilever did it well. Danone didn't do it well. That's the story behind Danone, not that they became basically the French equivalent of a public benefit corporation. And as Judge Stein says, I mean, it's really actually fairly conservative in the sense that it isn't sort of a stakeholder-driven, you know, kind of board. It's basically still a board of directors, and it's the investors who hold the board responsible for accomplishing the benefit that the public benefit corporation says it wants to do. Now, do I think in this particular political environment, we're going to see, you know, any major changes like that? Elizabeth Warren, you know, is kind of working towards that with some, you know, legislation she proposed a couple of years ago, which clearly didn't go anywhere. But I think it's something we have to confront, because what you see with single materiality and double materiality, I think, is you're trying to use corporate reporting through double materiality to drive companies in a more purposeful direction, if you will, although every company's purpose needs to be unique. We'll probably talk about an example of that in a minute. You really need to kind of get down to, you know, the really underlying fundamentals of company law. And if you have the equivalent of a public benefit corporation, then it more naturally leads into wanting to report on double materiality issues. So, but maybe that's more detail than we need to get into. So I'll stop.
All right. So while we're talking about this idea of fundamentally what needs to happen is that the company needs to view its purpose as being more just than just maximizing shareholder value. You've been trying to get companies to publish a statement of significant audiences and materiality. Can you tell our listeners what that is and why that's important? Or rather, how is it different than what our current disclosures are and what tangible impact it would have?
So that was kind of the original term, Natalie, that I developed with Tim Yeomans in my book, The Integrated Reporting Movement. That didn't fall easily on the ears, neither Tim or I are marketing people, as you can probably tell. So it's now statement of purpose. So we'd come out with this notion before the Business Roundtable came out with their big statement. So we were enthused. We thought, okay, this is great. They said, you know, every corporation has a purpose. What, in the language of statement of significant audiences, materiality, the idea is the board of directors publish a simple 1 or 2 page statement that just says, here is the purpose of the company. Why does this company exist? What stakeholders are important? What are the timeframes that we use to evaluate our impact on these stakeholders, including shareholders? How do we make trade-off decisions? And, you know, it's pretty high level, but what's key about it is that it deals with stakeholders. Can't say we're going to take care of everybody because no company's got infinite resources. You know, how do you think about trade-offs? I mean, there was trade-offs in COVID. Were you going to keep your dividends and fire employees the other way? You know, if you had purpose as sort of your North Star, that would have given you some guidance. And as I said, it's got to be unique. So when I talk to companies about the statement of purpose, the typical pushback I get is the following. Particularly in the United States, they go, well, I can't do that. Fiduciary duty, I'm going to get sued, blah, 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 blah. And I mean, okay, wait a second. It's like, give me a break, right? You know, Business Roundtable did this thing, said every company's got a unique purpose. They go, you know, Bob, we don't need to do this. We've got a mission statement, got a values statement. Okay, great. Where's that? Oh, it's on our website. It's on a sustainability report. And you look at them and they're pretty thin gruel. They're, you know, paragraph at best. They're interchangeable. It's like a bank says, you know, our purpose is to take care of the financial needs of our customers in a fair and inclusive way and protect their privacy and leverage modern technology. That could be any bank. You know, there's nothing particularly unique about that. And probably most importantly, who's accountable for it? Who's accountable for a mission statement and a sustainability report? The statement of purpose is signed by the board of directors. Investors want to know, what does the board think the purpose of this corporation? What are the material issues that need to be dealt with? It's up to management then to figure out what the metrics should be, and they can leverage the reporting stuff we talked about earlier. And it's really sort of the foundation, because right now investors are quite cynical about all this corporate talk about purpose, because when they go and they talk to the directors, if they can get to them, which they usually can't, because the investor relations function is like, you know, a blocking tackle, you know, keeping them from, you know, talking to the directors, they, you know, can't explain what it is. You know, oh, I you know, we're a good company and we're going to make money and produce cars or whatever. So I'm somewhat, as you can tell, cynical, where there's been all this talk about purpose, and I've been singularly unsuccessful in getting companies to publish a statement of purpose. You know, I've got the one example we'll talk about later, and I think it's telling, because it shows to me there's a lack of authenticity.
Right. And all those, I imagine, would be are huge impediments in order to get any of these companies really to care about these issues. So it sounds a bit like you're trying to almost push these companies to make themselves more like public benefit corporations, give, you know, in the absence of like federal regulation. Is that correct? Or am I misinterpreting that?
No, you know, I think, you know, what, in a paper that I wrote with Leo Strine and Tim Yeomans, the guy that I developed the idea with, called, you know, Three Ways to Put Your Corporate Purpose into Action, that was published in HBR, which said there's three steps. First is statement of purpose, and that's within, you know, Delaware law as it is today. You know, kind of what is your purpose? You know, and it's like within the law, you know, your duty is to the company and its shareholders, but, you know, like, why do you exist as a company? You know, what profitable solutions for people and planet are you producing? You know, in the language of my colleague, Colin Mayer. Then do integrated reporting. And what these standards we were talking about earlier will make that more authentic, because, as I said, I was involved in the creation of the International Integrated Reporting Council. We had a framework, but we remained agnostic about standards, GRSS, because that wasn't our job. And then if you want to take the third step, that's when you become a public benefit corporation. So think of it as not the statement of purpose trying to, you know, kind of be a proxy for a public benefit corporation. Think of it as a first step along the way. Integrated reporting is the way you demonstrate how you're accomplishing your purpose or not. And then if you want to take the really big step, you know, you convert to a public benefit corporation.
Got it. So let's talk about that one company you think has actually been shown itself to be
that mysterious, controversial one company you're going to mention. Yes.
Yes. So as everyone knows, many ESG strategies screen out certain industries, like sin industries, such as firearms, gambling, and tobacco. So you've been working closely with Philip Morris, which is a tobacco company. Would you like to explain why Philip Morris?
So I'd be happy to explain. And certainly when, you know, Mr. Sustainability, Bob Eccles, you know, announced that he was going to become an advisor to Philip Morris, the reaction was interesting. I have to say that, you know, for the most part, people were positive. You know, there's some people that hate me now, and I've got some NGOs where I have a target on my back, but that's life. And, you know, it's a story for another day. So why would I agree to work with a tobacco company? Long Shaggy Dog story. I won't get into the details, but they basically have a purpose to create a smoke-free world. And what they have committed to is getting out of the cigarette business as quickly as they can. Cigarettes kill people. We know that. What kills people is the burning of the tobacco. It's not the nicotine. What people are addicted to is nicotine. It's a highly addictive drug. It's up there with like heroin and cocaine and whatever. So they've developed a heated tobacco product, and I won't get into the details, called IQOS, which delivers nicotine in a way that's very similar to the experience people have smoking a cigarette, which is much less harmful. And they've got all kinds of scientific data. It's not harmless. Their position is don't smoke. If you smoke, quit. If you can't quit, change. And so they have committed to, for example, in their integrated report and in their investor presentations, that by 2025, more than half of their revenues will be from reduced risk products, this heated tobacco product, which, by the way, isn't attractive to teenagers. It's not the same as vaping. People in the United States get very confused between vaping and heated tobacco. And, you know, there's all the missteps that Juul made. And so it's like, okay, you are cannibalizing your core business, a very profitable core business, to, you know, sell a product which is less risky. But they've also committed to having at least $1 billion in sales from non-nicotine products. So one of the interesting things about their transformation, where they've gone from a B2B business, cigarette business is pretty simple. You grow the tobacco, you send it to a factory, you make the cigarette, put it on a truck, goes to some retail outlet or into, you know, an airport, people buy it and they walk away and they smoke the cigarettes. With IQOS, because it's a device, it's like a little mini cigarette that's put in this metal device and there's a battery that heats it up. They've become a B2C business. So they've got direct relationships with the consumers, and they've learned a ton about how you deliver substances into the body. So right now they're delivering nicotine. They could deliver, who knows, you know, aspirin, you know, COVID shots. I mean, you know, whatever it is, I'm not a scientist. And so this is the most dramatic business transformation I've ever seen. So why would I worry them? So they come to me and I say, well, it's a little complicated. And, well, why don't you come to Lausanne? That's where they're headquartered, although they're a US company, and that's important for reasons I'll explain in a second. So I go to Lausanne and I, you know, meet with all their senior executives, and people that invited me there was a gentleman named Luke Salvicles, who was the chief sustainability officer who retired. And now this is interesting. The current chief sustainability officer is a woman named Jennifer Motlis, who reports to the CFO. We'll come back to that. So I meet with everybody, and I'm meeting with Andre Kalantzopoulos, who's the CEO. And I'm supposed to meet with him for an hour, and it's like 5 hours. And I'm going, well, you know, Andre, this is sort of an interesting situation. Like, I'm a good guy, and you're the CEO of a tobacco company. You're one of the worst companies in the world. I mean, you know, all these people are excluding tobacco. So if we're going to work together, you know, one thing you're going to have to do is a statement of purpose. And Andre goes, what's that? I explained, he says, oh yeah, it's good. And I said, but Andre, it's gotta be more than a statement of purpose. I mean, we need to have an integrated report to explain how you're doing it. He said, what's an integrated report? I explained, he says, well, we can do that. So a year faster than we had scheduled it, their integrated report came out. Their first one was for 2019. In their 2019 proxy statement, so then a year before that, they've got a statement of purpose signed by every member of their board of directors that's in their proxy statement. They are a U.S. listed company on the New York Stock Exchange. This is really important to note. Here is a U.S. tobacco company. No company's got a bigger litigation target on their back than a tobacco company. Their board of directors have all endorsed, I think it's about 3 pages statement of purpose, which you can read in their proxy statement. And you don't get a much more official filing document than a proxy statement. Then they followed it up with a very good integrated report for 2019. And then the 2020 integrated report is even better. And as I said, Jenny, who's the CSO, reports to the CFO. That's important for 2 reasons. Manuel Babeau, who came in from Schneider. So one of the issues around sustainability reporting, is this really sustainability core to the company strategy? Or is it this kind of philanthropy sideshow, you know, with community works and stuff from the second class citizens and CSR over the years? No, Jenny reports to the CFO, who's in charge of strategy and capital allocation. So sustainability is at the absolute core of what PMI does. And by the way, one of the concerns people have about integrated reporting when you talk to CFOs, that the data aren't as good because the systems aren't as good. They aren't as robust. You don't have the big ERPs. So if you put the sustainability function under the CFO, who's the person that's responsible for the quality and integrity and robustness of the internal control and measurement systems, then you start to raise the quality of sustainability data to be the same as financial data. That'll be helped by standards, and I think ultimately need to have an audit. And if you look at PMI's presentations, they had an investor day. You look at, you know, their quarterly calls. I did something with one of the analysts. The sustainability story is absolutely core because their purpose is to get out of the cigarette business. 1 billion people smoke cigarettes. Who projects that to be constant for the next 5 years? And this is where the exclusion thing is fine. It's like, it's complicated when we get into it, but all these people excluding tobacco stocks, if you want to exclude tobacco stocks, because you don't want to make money off of a product that kills people. I get it. That is a values-based decision. People have their own values. You don't like pornography. You don't like alcohol. You know, you don't like, you know, landmines and whatever. I mean, that's fine. Don't kid yourself to think that excluding tobacco stocks is going to solve the problem of a billion people smoking cigarettes. It's highly addictive. There's huge excise taxes. 70% of the price of a package of cigarettes are the excise taxes. The United States tobacco companies pay $26, $27 billion a year in excise taxes through this master settlement agreement. Guess what percentage of that is used for tobacco control programs? 3%. So there's all this duplicity on the part of these governments that have all signed on to the WHO Framework Convention of Tobacco Control, and we're not going to engage with the tobacco company. We hate them, and they're terrible, and we're going to exclude them. Please give us the excise taxes. It's 10% of, you know, government revenues in some countries. Almost none of that money is going to tobacco control, so there's a lack of authenticity there. So kudos to PMI. You know, the NGOs are beating up on them, and then the people are excluding them, and the government said they're going to talk to them. Man, they are powering on. I think what they are is a beacon for the rest of the industry. They've got a statement of purpose. They've got an integrated report. They've committed to cannibalizing their cigarette business. And the investment community, you know, is starting to understand this. Are the people that exclude tobacco stocks going to change their mind? Not in the near term. But if we just want to talk about the problem of eliminating cigarette smoking, and PMI says that in some markets with the right government policies, cigarette smoking can be eliminated in 10 to 15 years. That would be great, but you have to work and you have to engage with tobacco companies. It's the same thing with the oil and gas companies. People say, well, I'm going to be net zero by 2050. How are you going to do it? Well, I'm going to get out of oil and gas. Okay, so, you know, you've fixed your portfolio. You haven't fixed the problem. Another example I'd like to talk about, I knew the people involved at CalSTRS and Engine Number One, is the campaign against ExxonMobil. We probably don't have time to get into it. I've written about it a lot. They placed three out of four in an alternative slate of directors on the ExxonMobil board of directors. So I think, and that's been a wake-up call. I can tell you that's a wake-up call to every oil and gas industry, to all other high emitting companies. If Engine Number One, which is kind of nobody'd heard of and didn't have a big investment, $20 million, whatever it was, they can do that. All these other companies are saying, you know, we'd better pay attention. And so if you really want to affect change and you want to accomplish the SDGs, and you want to deal with these negative externalities and not just say, well, we're only going to invest in nice stuff, green stuff, divest the bad stuff. You need to think about what I like to call engagement and transition financing. Exxon's got to change. The tobacco companies have got to change. The food companies have got to change. I think more people die of obesity than cigarette smoking. You know, I'll kind of quit ranting on and on and on. But, you know, I've done some research, you know, with Shiva, you know, we're kind of making more progress on this. You've got to be very clear in your exclusion policies. Is it values-based reasons? Because you just don't want to own that stock because it's, you know, reprehensible to you for whatever reasons. That's perfectly fine. But don't go pat yourself on the back and say, well, I'm doing a good thing for the world because I'm excluding the stock and it's going to somehow make the problem go away. It's not. So don't kid yourself.
Right. And an equivalent I can think of PMI within the oil and gas industry would have been Ørsted, which previously was mostly operating off of natural gas, but they, instead of funneling money into climate science denial, they've done essentially the full transition to now renewable wind energy. And so, you know, like you said, good luck excluding the companies that all of us rely on to power our homes and run all this Zoom and all these other video conferencing applications we've been so dependent on for the past year and a half.
Ørsted is a good example. It's a good example. I'm glad you raised it. It's a very good example.
Okay, so now we're kind of entering the last phase of our talk today. So all this has been really interesting. And the last thing I wanted to ask you was, are there any ESG trends in 2022 that we should be on the lookout for, things that maybe people haven't been paying too much attention to that you think are going to become big issues?
Yeah, you know, as Yogi Berra said, predictions are always difficult, especially about the future. So, you know, kind of walking on eggshells here a little bit. I think one of the things that you see, which is very much prominent, and so I think it's going to continue into 2022, is just the authenticity of the claims around ESG investing. You've got the DWS story, the woman Desiree Fixler, who was brought in to, you know, basically help them raise their game around what they're doing with the ESG investing. So she tries to point out some problems and they throw her under the bus. And then they go, they leak an internal memo, which wasn't very smart. They should have just given her $5 million and signed a mutual non-disparagement agreement. So then, you know, she explains her story. Now you've got BaFin, the German financial regulator, the SEC, the Department of Justice investigating them. And so I think a big issue, and you've got Tarik Fancy, probably people know his name, you know, he's written about this, got a lot of attention, Ken Pucker. I think it's fair to question the authenticity of what is kind of green investing, sustainable funds, green funds. When you peel back the covers a little bit, you know, it's pretty thin gruel in some cases. It's like, okay, it's a green fund. We don't have any tobacco, oil, and gas. We've loaded up on FANGs. That's 80% of the market cap, and they've got their own.
And they don't produce any physical waste.
Yeah, they don't produce any physical waste. They don't use a lot of carbon. And it's like, okay, there's, you know, human rights issues with them, and there's privacy issues with them, and there's business model issues and dual class share structures. And it's like, okay, this is all pretty nuts. So like, what is meant? The Financial Conduct Authority, I'm going to be writing about them. So I've written about the DWS story. I've got a little column on Forbes.com, 7 principles for ESG investing, a conversation with Desiree Fixler. And kudos to her. The woman is a hero and she's brave. So, and it's been a pleasure to get to know her. So, and the FCA's got some standards. So one of the things I think you're going to see, the SEC is looking into it. The EU has got the SFDR, the Sustainable Finance Directive on Reporting, where they've got so-called Article 8 and Article 9 funds. So I think one of the things, trends we're going to see is the trying to put some order, you know, into this universe of ESG funds and kind of what they mean. A trend I'd like to see, and I've hinted at that, and I'm starting to see a little bit of evidence, is that we can't spend our way to green, as I like to say. So not all money can go into Article 8 and Article 9 funds or green funds. We need transition money, as we were talking about before, for these industries that are producing these negative externalities. You've got sustainability-linked bonds. I mean, I think that's a way to do it. I think you're going to see more action in the fixed income markets. In some ways, fixed income is a place where you can exercise more influence on a company when they're issuing a bond than, you know, a stock that's just out there floating around in the market. Then people can buy or sell. I think we're going to see the impact as these standards start to get put into place. I think that's going to be important. Other trends, I mean, I'll tell you the trend I'd like to see. And a person who says this is my friend, Carol Jeremiah, who's the president of MFS Investments. It's a big active manager in Boston. It's got about $650 billion in AUM now. I like to see this term ESG funds investing go away, right? I mean, it's like if we really believe that this is core to investing, you might want to have thematic funds. You can say, you know, this is a thematic fund around water or social inequality or something. But to kind of have sort of ESG funds that are, a lot of them are just based on these simplistic exclusions. Then we've talked about, you know, what that really does. I think if it just became table stakes and as part of the core investment process that every portfolio manager for whatever sector has a view on what the material issues are and is incorporating those into their financial analysis and portfolio decisions, and having standards will help on that. I think that would be a great trend. And then I think the kind of frontier, and this is something that this G7, you know, task force is working on, is ESG is really about a company's operations and activities. An impact is about the positive and negative externalities, really with its products and services. And in carbon language, it would be scope 3, right? It's things that are sort of in the way your products and services are being used. That's where the impact comes from. That's where people talk about the sustainable development goals. Impact measurement really does require to do it properly, data from outside the company, because it's outcomes and context. So I think what you're going to see is attempts to try and become more rigorous about talking about impact, about measuring impact, about making that more authentic. You know, and kind of making this connection tighter between the externalities, you know, and the SDGs than is being done right now, where it's more kind of on a narrative basis. And, you know, a trend I'd like to see, but I don't think I'm going to see, we talked about earlier, is some fundamental, you know, rethinking about corporate form, you know, and addressing these issues around company law. So that's my best guess, Natalie, for 2022.
All right. Robert, thank you for taking the time for the podcast, and thank you for sharing all your wisdom.
Hello, Value Walk listeners. I want to thank you for your time. If you have any guest recommendations, questions, comments, and feedback, please email me at rpanganaban@valuewalk.com. I would love to hear back from you and appreciate your support. Thank you again.